This first poem is especially interesting to me tonight because of, first of all, the coincidences that take place inside the poem, but even more so because of a little coincidence that I came across when I plucked this book off my shelf tonight. When I left Minneapolis in August, I thought I might want to take a Frost book along, so I grabbed the smallest one that we had in the house and never looked at it at all until I got here. Tonight I looked at it. And I saw this poem at the beginning and I thought I would read that one, but then I saw two pieces of paper sticking out near the back of the book. And I pulled them out. And what do I find? Two fragments with some writing on them. And it's my deceased wife's handwriting. And it really surprised me because there it was, you know, and she's been dead for 3 years, and here were two little tags in there, which was interesting because I'd been thinking about the connectedness of things in this poem, and here found those two pieces of paper. And I don't know when they were put there, but it's interesting because it's a kind of a message to me from someone I wasn't expecting a message from. And here in this poem, we see something very similar to that. And another little incident that took place recently, I some of you probably have known death in your family, someone near you, and although my parents have died, and after that I was away, but after my wife died, a lot of mail kept coming. I suppose some of you have had that experience, and most of it was mail that need not be opened, but about a week before I left Minneapolis in August, a little box came about that high, about like that square, and it was it was a box addressed to my wife in her handwriting. So wow, that really set me off, you know? And I thought, what in the world is going on here? It was just such a marvelous experience to see that, but also a little bit puzzling. And so I opened it up. And she had given some of her photographic slides to someone when she had been doing some workshops in southern Minnesota. She had given them to someone at one of the nature centers, and he had used them and hadn't returned them. And get this, now they were sent to her, which I opened up, and they were sent by the wife of that man. And that man had died. And the woman who sent them to me didn't know that my wife had died. So here she was writing to my deceased wife, apologizing for not sending these photographs. Isn't that amazing? Well, so that was the little serendipity for tonight. Here's the poem. Robert Frost, you know what it's like. Some of you, I suppose, are almost old enough to know the days when we had scythes, which we used, or sickles to cut grass, that sort of thing. This is called The Tuft of Flowers. I went to turn the grass once after one who mowed it in the dew before the sun. The dew was gone that made his blade so keen before I came to view the leveled scene. I looked for him behind an aisle of trees. I listened for his whetstone on the breeze. But he had gone his way, the grass all mown, and I must be, as he had been, alone. As all must be, I said within my heart, whether they work together or apart. But as I said it, swift there passed me by, on noiseless wing, a bewildered butterfly, seeking with memories grown dim o'er night, some resting flower of yesterday's delight. And once I marked his flight go round and round as where some flowers lay withering on the ground. And then he flew as far as I could see and on tremulous wing came back to me. I thought of questions that have no reply and would have turned to toss the grass to dry, but he turned first and led my eye to look at a tall tuft of flowers beside a brook, a leaping tongue of bloom the scythe had spared beside a reedy brook
the scythe had bared. I left my place to know them by their name, finding them butterfly weed when I came. The mower in the dew had loved them thus, leaving them to flourish, not for us, nor yet to draw one thought of ours to him, but from sheer morning gladness at the brim. The butterfly and I had lit upon, nevertheless, a message from the dawn that made me hear the wakening birds around and hear his long scythe whispering to the ground and feel a spirit kindred to my own, so that henceforth I worked no more alone. But glad with him, I worked as with his aid, and weary, sought at noon with him the shade. And dreaming, as it were, held brotherly speech with one whose thought I had not hoped to reach. Men work together, I told him from the heart, whether they work together or apart. That fly was interesting, like the butterfly coming back down. Well, I think it's an interesting poem that he changes his mind about working alone and working apart. Birches is one of his famous poems. I don't know if you've heard it ad nauseum. I don't have to read it again. Is there anybody who is sick of it? Well, we'll whip through it then. It's worth hearing again, I suppose. In reading these poems, I hope that you're concentrating especially hard, if you don't know them clearly, to get the situation. Where are we? What's going on? And notice, I think that if you can keep in mind that the best listener or reader of poems is someone who has had the same experience as the poet. So oftentimes when we read something, especially something new, we expect to learn something from it. Oh, that's new information for me, that sort of thing. But I think poetry and all art is appreciated most if we treat it as a return to an experience and knowing that experience slightly differently now because of the manner in which this person, this painter, or this musician, or this poet has presented the experience to us. That writer's words, for example, the rhythms, or the idea that she or he took from that experience. So that, again, to repeat that, the best readers of poems are those who don't expect to learn something new necessarily, but who expect to say, okay, I've also done that. Let's see if you've noticed something about it that I haven't. And usually, if we're with a good poet, we'll say, you know, I never thought of that. Or, by gosh, I thought of it the same way, but I didn't take the time to put it into language. Or, I thought of it, but not quite the same way. Or, you're just a little bit more perceptive than I am, perhaps. Okay, we've all climbed trees when we're young, and we've watched people climbing them, and here's Robert Frost in the tree. Birches. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay. Ice storms do that. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves, and their breeze rises and turn many-colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break. Though once they are bowed so long, for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good both going and coming back. One could be worse. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. We did mending wall today in class. I won't read that one now. Here it is. You've all been faced with situations, moral, ethical situations, wherein you had to make a decision which was almost irresolvable. If you did this, okay, those are the benefits and the losses, and the opposite. Well, here's one I wonder if any one of you has ever had. Probably not, chances aren't, but a honeymoon couple, love and a question. A stranger came to the door at eve, and he spoke the bridegroom fair. He bore a green-white stick in his hand, and for all the burden care. He asked, with the eyes more than the lips, for a shelter for the night, and he turned and looked at the road afar without a window light. The bridegroom came forth into the porch with, "Let us look at the sky and question what of the night to be, stranger, you and I." The woodbine leaves littered the yard. The woodbine berries were blue. Autumn, yes, winter was in the wind. Stranger, I wish I knew. Within, the bride in the dusk alone bent over the open fire, her face rose red with the glowing coal, and he thought of her heart's desire. The bridegroom looked at the weary road, yet saw but her within, and wished her heart in a case of gold, and pinned with a silver pin. The bridegroom thought it little to give a dole of bread, a purse, a heartfelt prayer for the poor of God, or for the rich a curse. But whether or not a man was asked to mar the love of two by harboring woe in the bridal house, the bridegroom wished he knew. Tough one, huh? Robert Frost spent a lot of his time outdoors, as you probably know. And he had a special interest in trees and flowers and water, that sort of thing. And he made a lot of very interesting observations about their relationships. And he sometimes saw them at odds with each other and sometimes as harmonious. But here's one. It's called Spring Pools. These pools that in forests still reflect the total sky almost without defect, and like the flowers beside them, chill and shiver, will, like the flowers beside them, soon be gone, and yet not out by any brook or river, but up by the roots to bring dark foliage on. The trees that have it in their pent-up buds to darken nature and be summer woods, let them think twice before they use their powers to blot out and drink up and sweep away these flowery waters and these watery flowers from snow that melted only yesterday. Have you ever noticed that? I don't know. Do you have pools out here in Washington where trees, you've got so much water out here, the trees don't need to take the water away from the flowers, huh? Have you thought about why Eve came? Robert Frost did. Anybody know this poem? Why Eve came? You've heard of Eve. Good. Never again would birdsong be the same. He would declare and could himself believe that the birds there in all the garden round, from having heard the delaying voice, excuse me, the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning, but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence upon birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as may be, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would bird song be the same. And to do that to birds was why she came.
I suppose we thought she was ours rather than the birds too.
And you've all seen a wasp. Got a good picture of a wasp there standing in silhouette perhaps. Maybe someone would like to write that fly away. Waspish. On glossy wires artistically bent, he draws himself up to his full extent. His natty wings with self-assurance perk, his stinging quarters menacingly work. Poor egotist, he has no way of knowing, but he's as good as anybody going. This one's a little bit longer than the last one, but I've enjoyed listening to students in high school discuss this poem so much. And the question that they can't resolve is whether Frost is writing about ants to illuminate people's behavior, or whether he's writing about ants and using the metaphor of people to illuminate ant behavior. I've never seen that resolved in a group of high school students, whether he's writing about ants to show how we are, or he uses a metaphor of people to show how ants are. So you can decide this one, okay? It's called departmental. An ant on the tablecloth ran into a dormant moth of many times his size. He showed not the least surprise. His business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his duty run. Yet if he encountered one of the Hive's enquiry squad, whose work is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would put him onto the case. Ants are a curious race. One crossing with hurried tread the body of one of their dead isn't given a moment's arrest. Seems not even impressed. But he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses antennae, and they no doubt report to the higher up at court. Then word goes forth in formic. Deaths come to Jerry McCormick, our selfless forager Jerry. Will the special janissary, whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, go bring him home to his people? Lay him in state on a sepal, wrap him for shroud in a petal, embalm him with ichor of nettle. This is the word of your queen. And presently on the scene appears a solemn mortician, and taking formal position with feelers calmly at twiddle, seizes the dead by the middle, and heaving him high in air, carries him out of there. No one stands round to stare. It is nobody else's affair. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental. It's interesting, there's a line in there that's different from the way that poem is written in some of my other texts. So what's your answer? Is he writing about ants to illuminate people behavior? Or is he more writing, using people metaphor to illuminate ants behavior? Anybody have a thought on that? You don't care, huh? He illuminates both of them. One of my all-time favorites. For probably 25 years, I have been trying to find the right combination of spider and moth and flower to get a photograph of this phenomenon here that he has experienced, called design. And I've gotten a picture with a white moth on a heel awl although it wasn't a white helal. And I've got a picture of a spider, but it isn't a white spider, but it's not on a helal at all. So I'm far from it. I don't expect ever to get it, but anytime I'm where there are helal flowers and there are moths or spiders around, I'm especially alert and I don't leave without giving a good search. Design. I found a dimpled spider. Do you know this spider? I don't know if it's out here in the West. It's in the Midwest. I see them. We have them in our garden, yard. It's called a crab spider, also called a snowdrop spider. It's very white, got little dimples on it, and it likes to... It doesn't get its food by building a web, but rather it captures it by leaping, much as a wolf spider would. And it sits there, draws back in seclusion, and then comes out and takes food. Anyhow, design. I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white helal, a flower, a white helal flower. I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white helal, holding up a moth like a white piece of rigid satin cloth. Assorted characters of death and blight, mixed, ready to begin the morning rite, like the ingredients of witch's broth. A snowdrop spider, a flower-like froth, and dead wings carried like a paper kite. What had that flower to do with being white, the wayside blue and innocent helal? What brought the kindred spider to that height, then steered the white moth thither in the night? What but design of darkness to appall? If design govern in a thing so small. That one will keep people discussing for a long time. They get very philosophic about, is there design for such little things? We'll accept it sometimes for our own lives. That poem is especially interesting to me too, because we completely redesigned the curriculum in the English department, I guess the second year that I was in Minnesota, and in order to get approval, the school board required that we demonstrate some of the new things we were going to do, and the school had never had a course in poetry. And some of the other ones, they just said 10th, 11th, 12th grade English. And so I chose to demonstrate what the students would be doing in the poetry class. So I had about a dozen students up there on the stage, and I gave them this poem. They didn't see the poem before, but once they got there, they were allowed to study it for maybe about 15 minutes, and they had some dictionaries there if they needed them. And then I was talking to probably 400 or 500 citizens from the community who were there to learn about this new curriculum, how things might go. You know how people are, you take something away and wait a minute here now, what's going to replace it? See, so we had to prove that what we were going to do was decent, legitimate, and wasn't going to damage the minds of their children. Anyhow, they were discussing this poem, and the one question that I asked them was about the helo. I found a dimpled spider on a white helal. And then later in the poem, Frost writes, what had that flower to do with being white, the wayside blue and innocent helal? And in 32 years of teaching, I have only once known a student in the classroom who knows why, who first of all, who reads the line properly, I think, and that is that it's a blue helal. Why is it white? Does anybody know? Okay, you haven't had time to study the poem, but the helal is blighted, of course. Assorted characters of death and blight. The helal has been blighted. You see, that's another part of the design of the whole thing. In its health, the helal would be blue, but it has been blighted. So the blight that has attacked the colors, the pigments in the helal, causes it to be white. If it weren't white, the moth would not have gone there for protective camouflage. The spider would not have gone there for offensive camouflage so that it could attack something white that was coming there. So all of those things Frost sees as coming together. And he says, this is a marvelous design, he said. However, back to the occasion that night. And one of the students there was Julie McCookie. I remember her very well. And that was in 1962. And anyhow, they simply couldn't answer my question when I asked what to read that line. And they were reading the line, what had that
flower to do with being white, the wayside blue. They decided that the wayside was blue and the flower was white, see. Judah McCookie's dad was way in the back of the auditorium there, and the students were wrestling with this. They could make no progress whatsoever. And I remember he was so excited, he got up on top of a table like we eat lunch off of. There he was. He said, and we were about to break up. He said, I can't let anybody go. He said, I just want to show these kids that we old minds can read too. So he said, I'll explain to you that line about the, and he did a beautiful job of it. So that's one of the high moments of my teaching, I think, to remember that experience there, to see him, his excitement. And they did approve the course, so we had poetry. I was going to read one on the bear, but I think we're moving along a little too slowly here, so I'll let the bear go. You can read that yourself. The need on being versed in country things. Let's see, you're probably versed enough in country things. That's a nice poem. Here's one that maybe, it doesn't get anthologized often. You maybe haven't come across it. A Hillside Thaw. Have you ever seen this in any of your anthologies? A Hillside Thaw? It's, I find it especially interesting in the context of all of Frost's poems, because he never develops a metaphor so fully in his other poems that I know of as he does in this poem. A Hillside Thaw is just what he says here. And some of you who are going to be here in the spring, if the snow does eventually melt, and you go to the hillside, you will see that it will be coming down during the day and freezing at night. Okay, so we have a hillside thaw during the day, and as Frost certainly did in his home New England. And the imagery that he uses, the comparisons that he makes are especially delightful to me. Again, give this to young, untrained minds, and it takes quite a while for them to discern what's going on here. They can't see that comparison between the hillside thawing and the images that Frost uses to illuminate for us that hillside thawing, so that we can now look at it anew. So if you haven't seen the poem and you have watched the hillside thaw, after this poem, you should be sure to go back there and look at it the way that Frost did and say, yeah, or no, he missed it, or he was exaggerating, or whatever. Anyhow, here it goes. A hillside thaw. To think, to know the country, and not know the hillside on the day the sun lets go 10 million silver lizards out of snow. As often as I've seen it done before, I can't pretend to tell the way it's done. It looks as if some magic of the sun lifted the rug that bred them on the floor, and the light breaking on them made them run. But if I thought to stop the wet stampede and caught one silver lizard by the tail and put my foot on one without avail and threw myself well-elbowed and wet-kneed in front of 20 others wriggling speed, in the confusion of them all aglitter and birds that joined in the excited fun by doubling and redoubling song and twitter, I have no doubt I'd end by holding none. It takes the moon for this. The sun's a wizard, by all I tell, but so's the moon a witch. From the high west, she casts a gentle cast, and suddenly, without a jerk or twitch, she has her spell on every single lizard. I fancied when I looked at 6 o'clock, the swarm still ran and scuttled just as fast. The moon was waiting for her chill effect. I looked at 9. The swarm was turned to rock in every lifelike posture of the swarm, transfixed on mountain slopes, almost erect. Across each other and side by side they lay. The spell that so could hold them as they were was wrought through trees without a breath of storm to make a leaf if there had been one stir. It was the moon's. She held them until day. One lizard at the end of every ray. The thought of my attempting such a stay. Isn't Frost wonderful? I mean, weather Frost. sometimes a very small incident can completely change, reverse our attitude or idea about our day, ourselves, the smallest thing. And here's one that turned Frost around one day. Dust of snow. The way a crow shook down on me, the dust of snow from a hemlock tree has given my heart a change of mood and saved some part of a day I had rued. Marvelous power. And of course the sentence, I'm sure, was one way for Frost to emphasize the wholeness, the continuity, the singleness of this event that he is observing here. Again, it's the metaphor is such so that you don't really know which side you're on. Is he looking at lizards or is he looking at water going down the hill? See? And this one called The Silken Tent. She is as in a field, a silken tent, at midday, when a sunny summer breeze has dried the dew and all its ropes relent, so that in guise it gently sways at ease, and its supporting central cedar pole as is its pinnacle to heavenward and signifies the sureness of the soul, seems to owe naught to any single cord, but strictly held by none, is loosely bound by countless silken ties of love and thought to everything on earth the compass round, and only by one's going slightly taut in the capriciousness of summer air is of the slightest bondage made aware. I can't help but think of my mother when I read that because of her size when she was older, this little, looking a little like a tent in some of the dresses she wore, but also of her demeanor, her personality, you know. And how he can do that, compare this woman to this tent and be so complimentary about her, but to see that marvelous balance and central spirit that supported her. Wonder who it was that he had in mind when he was making that one. And this is the last one of Frost. And it's a prayer. It's again a poem that I've never seen in one of the anthologies where you get just a sampling of a person's work. A prayer in spring. Oh, give us pleasure in the flowers today, and give us not to think so far away as the uncertain harvest. Keep us here, all simply in the springing of the year. Oh, give us pleasure in the orchard white, like nothing else by day, like ghosts by night. And make us happy in the happy bees, the swarm dilating round the perfect trees. And make us happy in the darting bird that suddenly above the bees is heard, the meteor that thrusts in with needle bill and off a blossom in midair stands still. For this is love and nothing else is love, to which it is reserved for God above to sanctify to what four ends he will, but which it only needs that we fulfill. It's an interesting thought there, how God doesn't sanctify unless we are there to observe it. Well, now, Carl announced that I was going to read some of my poems. And I'm not so sure that I gave him permission to do that. Although if I don't, I'm afraid he is going to make me leave tomorrow, and I don't want to do that. But I'm afraid if I do, you're going to run me out of town up into the hills, and that'll be worse. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to read Robert Frost to you until midnight, and then I'll solve that problem. Well, this will be fun. If you don't mind, and since you're here, a few of them. Is that all right, Keith? I was sitting up at my desk one day and I glanced up, and this was on a clock where the hands still go around. Which way do they go? To you over there, okay. And I noticed at the 33rd second that there was a moth underneath the glass of the clock. And there was a sweep second hand that was coming around. And the first time that I saw it come around, I thought, uh-oh, somebody's going to get punched. But it didn't. It went right past the moth. And of course, it had probably been doing that long before I looked. So that fascinated me, partly because, well, the universal thought about how we see time fleeting and taking our lives and youth and whatever else away. And we like to arrest time. We like to stop it. See? So I saw a connection between that, and I thought, aha, if I could have my wish, maybe I'd be able to stop time, arrest it for a little while. And that's how this poem got started. And I don't know if I wrote it all down then or what. I can't remember how I finished it, but here it is. Glancing up at my desk. As the gold wand sweeps the circle clean of each old second, my hope and fear stir at the 33rd mark. Change is what I hope for. Hope for joy from fear that the insect, a winter moth, will lift its head, wing, anything to arrest time. If only to jar that 33rd moment of a perfect sweep in exchange for a safe rest on the smooth face below the coming blow. I had a class of students, and I asked them, where do poems come from? How do they get started? And they didn't have much to say, so I gave them a choice. I said, do you think more poems, they probably suggested something, but anyhow, I resolved it to two possibilities. I said, do you think more poems come from deep thought, from the power of an abstraction? For example, reading in the library maybe, or just thinking, sitting there musing? Or do you think it comes from some very hard physical experience, like hitting your finger, or falling off a mountain, or whatever, a sensory experience? And they're pretty evenly divided on that. The school, even though it was an urban school, was in an area that had quite a few acres, and there was a railroad track there, acres of open land, and a swamp and that sort of thing, but a railroad track right behind this school. So anyhow, I said, well, let's do this. Those of you who think that poems get started from meditation, from hard musing, you go into the library in a silent place and see what you can get going, and the rest go outside and see if you can have some special personal sense experience. And I went with one. Which group do you think I went with?
Outside.
Yeah, I did. That's right. Yeah. I mean, anytime a teacher can have an excuse to go outside, you're going to go. So I went outside too. And shortly after I went over the railroad track, between the railroad track and the swamp, I just happened to glance down, and here was a dead grackle. And any dead grackle to me is a blessing, because anyhow, I saw it there, and that's enough of a start for me to get some thoughts going, and I had my writing pad with me. So I sat down there and started making a poem, and I liked the way it was coming along and all, and a couple of things fell into place. And then after school, I went home and got my camera and came back and took a picture of that. And sometime later, I showed the slide to them, because I didn't tell them that I had gotten a poem going and had finished one out of it. Anyhow, here's the poem that I got from that experience. not at all expecting that day to make a poem. You know, I don't have to go into that about how people get themselves started into poems. And here it goes. To have seen that squirrel lacing the railroad track, and the squirrel was going down the railroad track, okay? To have seen that squirrel lacing the low air as he stitched his path tie by tie along the railroad track and barely glanced 5 feet to the side where the grackle had died, death couldn't stop him.
But this bird's going is more subtle grace. Her slow, rotting rebirth on and into the earth couldn't be stopped by the dying claws locked on the olive branch. We learn nothing from another's death. What's to know? So we gasp or weep or yawn, and then it's gone. Still, if we watch it go, see the act, forget the fact, the pulse of wind in wing will cheer the eye if we try to know when and how and why. The string that wound around this thing, a white wound, black leg lashed to last year's dead raspberry stem. Kite string, nest string, guesses. Who's to know? But the show that must have been, to have seen the string stop flight, the fight and the fling, the thrash as the winding lash wound tight, the fright, and then the dying in the night. There was a string that it, the grackle had caught somehow, and it had entangled it and was still wrapped around it. This is the first poem I think that I wrote. I'm not sure, but it's the oldest one that I think I have around, and it was in 1962. There were two children, two daughters in the family already, and my wife knit almost every evening, and we were sitting in our rather barren living room, I recall, and Betsy, the older one, had been playing with the yarn and had taken it apart. And I don't know if I was trying to make a poem that night or not. I don't think I was. However, I was watching her, and I do remember getting this poem going while I was watching her. Betsy had taken the yarn out of the ball, and my wife was putting it back into a ball again. And I was watching that, thinking, you know, that's a kind of a difficult thing. And I guess I was writing her, and then I thought, but what I'm trying to do is also difficult. So I saw a comparison between her attempt to get that yarn back into a neat ball again and my attempt to get some language into a neat shape, package. So here it is. After the children are in bed, I watch her at her task. I watch her at her task of rolling yarn into a ball again. I know she'll never ask for help from double rows of books along the wall. No one has seen the need to explain how to separate the sea's weed. Who knows who works harder? She to put a raveled skein in order, or I a poem within its border? My intense concentration interests her. And now she knows what I'm after, asks, give up? But without answer, I smile, because an hour is done, and neither one is any further in the task. Maybe one more, let's see here. My father died in 1969, and I don't know how soon after that I wrote this poem, but I was aware for several times after that how quickly we forget the power and the impact and the special nature of such an event, how it's gone. And I was driving home from school one day, and I saw this dead squirrel on the road, and didn't make much of it, and on the street. And then I noticed it for several days, and that gave me this idea right here about how we forget things and notice some things. Going home. Not that the squirrel cares, we care, who track him with cars, who dodge or aim as he enters the lane. And the hair and color and bones slain still mark a spot much less forgot than the burial plot our fathers wrought, safe and clean. Maybe and maybe not. Here's one I don't think I'll read to you. I've never liked it. Everybody likes it that I've given it to, but I've never liked the poem at all, and I don't really know why.
but I, at least young people do, and maybe because of the spectacular nature of it. I wrote it in my head on the way to school one morning. Just before I left the house, I heard on the radio that a former student who was, he was now graduated, yes, he was out of school for a half year maybe, and that he had been shot to death by the police last night in downtown Minneapolis. That the police had entered his apartment where he and his girlfriend were, and they came, and they were going to subdue his girlfriend, I guess, and he took a lamp, I guess, to try to stop them, and one of them shot him and killed him right there. And that was a kind of a special experience for me to hear that over the radio, so I made that poem, but I don't think it's worth reading. I don't think it's really very good. Here's a better one. Well, if you really want to see it, you have to look at it though too, because of the way it's laid out on the page, I think. And this, I guess this is the last. I've got two more here. I'll read these two quickly. Because of my strong interest in photography, I often have the wish that I could lose my mind, not know, not be able to abstract, you see, that I could be all eye, because photography is a matter of light, just pure light. The camera doesn't know those are flowers. All the camera knows is light. And to be a good photographer, I want to be able to see light the way that film knows light. And of course, the object, the thing that the mind knows, is always something of an interference because I'm influenced by that. So my hope, my prayer oftentimes is, I want no mind, I just want to be pure eye. I just want to be able to know light, because if I'm silent now, and if you plug your noses and you keep your eyes open, that's all you've got. You've just got light. You think it's me here, but you see, if the light weren't responding differently to this shape, well, anyhow, that's an interest that I have. And I was sitting in the living room one afternoon, late afternoon in October, and I was especially aware of how the light was coming off of some cactus and an orange tree, a Calamondin orange, and some fern in the living room there. And I was working very hard to try to get rid of the cactus and the orange and the fern. I didn't want them there. I didn't want to be thinking that vegetation. I wanted just to see the light. And here it is. In October, there's a light that lies along the edge of things, leaps and springs at eyes, sings in disguise as cactus, orange, and fern. And I waver between mind and eye, knowing my sight and seeing what's known. But I want only light to see purely, all eye, bright, and a darkness of mind until things lose their names and fruit and fern burn in flames, and eye and edge and sun are one. That's what I want, but I'll never get that, of course, because of my stupid mind that keeps getting in the way. And here's the last one. My garage is my workplace, and I for wood. I really like working with wood. In fact, right now on my pillow, there's a piece of wood that I fetched from up at the sawmill the first day that I was here. I suppose subconsciously I was not close to the garage and home where this sawed wood is able to please me. And I thought, aha, I felt around, there's this piece of wood, and I picked it up, and good, it just rich with aroma. So I sneaked it home hoping that Sven wouldn't see me, and it's up in my room now. And anyhow, I like wood a lot, and I have a difficult time throwing it away. And so they're all kinds of tiny little pieces. And when the daughters knew I was moving, they just
they urged me to get rid of it. And of course, over the last few months, I've been getting rid of piece by piece by piece. But it's interesting how often since I've done that I needed just that piece that I threw away. You people who keep things, you know that. And I called one of them who isn't at home right now, and I told her, I said, Sarah, I threw away some wood because of you. You kept pestering me to throw all that stuff away, see? And anyhow, I have a hard time throwing away wood. And there's one place in here where I haven't finished a word. I don't know if I was going to write board or what there, but I like it without that. I'll just make the noise, B. It means there's a B there, okay? On throwing away old wood, it's easier to bury the dead than toss a scrap of wood away. Here I must judge, know the date death is due, without the deadly accurate distance judges sit. Here I feel, smell the scraps whose greater parts are walls, frames, siding, closets, beds, and no, not scraps, new objects, things, themselves, I've made from parent pieces, unnailed, unglued, heaped, haphazard. But it's not what I see that troubles, it's here, me I feel, where passion, action, pleasure mix as judgment fades and the wood is saved to be stored again. I was cleaning out my garage and I couldn't do it. I had as much left as it was just rearranged a little differently. That's all.